Michael J. for Hope for the Warriors. Started back in 06 at Camp Lejeune. Military families witnessing the effects of war on their loved ones. Now, almost 20 years later, they've aided over 53,000 service members, veterans, and families with confidential, high-quality behavioral health care services at little or no cost to post 9/11 vets and their families. Over 91% of every dollar donated goes directly to the programs. If you're as concerned about our heroes as I am, go to hopeforthewarriors.org.
This is ContactTalkRadio.com, consciousness in action, and you are taking action into your consciousness by tuning into Contact Talk Radio.
And on TuneIn.com, Ping.fm, and Upsnap Mobile.
Contact Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Dr. Madeira Show, where he will discuss testosterone optimization and full body health for the high-performance modern man. Now, here's your host, Dr. Madeira.
Hello, everyone. It's Dr. Madeira back here on the Dr. Madeira Show, and we have a special guest here, Todd Ulizio. How's it going today, Todd?
Great.
Thanks for being a guest on the show. And Todd is an organic farmer here in the Flathead Valley, Whitefish, Montana area. So Northwest Montana, for those who aren't familiar with this greater county area. And you have your farm, Two Bear Farm, here. And how long have you been farming there? And kind of what's your story of how you got into organic farming?
My wife, Rebecca, and I have been farming for 12 years. So we're just about to head into our 13th growing season. We actually met in 2007 here in Whitefish and promptly started our first farm up near Eureka the following year. The journey to get to organic farming was not super direct, kind of a convoluted path, but I did grow up on a small vegetable farm in Connecticut. So as a kid, growing food and eating food were, you know, very connected types of activities. I never thought I would be a farmer as an adult as a way to make a living, but after working in wildlife biology and the conservation field and getting back into growing my own food, just a desire to be outside, recognizing the issues with the current food system, it seemed like a good transition. And I came to Whitefish to work on a farm, and that's the year I met my wife. And she had the similar passion to start farming. And so things kind of moved fast. And within a year, we had started. But we started small. We started on a quarter of an acre, sort of self-financed. And we're now one of the larger vegetable farms in Western Montana. We have 13 acres of certified organic vegetables in production.
Awesome. And do you also sell fruits from the farm too, like strawberries or anything like that? Or?
We don't, just given that we're in the northwest corner of the valley, we are probably in the coldest part.
Okay.
And Montana is a challenging growing climate to begin with.
Right.
So most of the fruit production takes place closer to Flathead Lake, where they have a little bit of a lake effect.
Okay.
With us, the frost can be so late in the spring and so early in the fall that it just is too much risk for us. So we stick to what we know,
right,
which is vegetables.
Excellent. Great. So I want to, now that people kind of know who you are and the context of our conversation, I wanted to kind of share your expertise with everybody in the audience about the importance of eating organic vegetables and produce versus the conventional fruits and vegetables in the grocery stores, and why that's important. And maybe we can talk about educating them more about the big agribusiness of farming in the United States and, I guess, you know, North America at large. But we got a big snowfall outside going on, folks. So that's what that noise was. And so maybe we can start with the more macro picture of big agribusiness, the importance of organic, and how people can check and get tuned into that in their communities.
Sure. It's a huge topic. I guess if you think back to the history of agriculture in this country, even if we just go back to like World War II, 1945, 30% of Americans were farming. And so basically everybody knew a farmer or was a farmer.
Right.
And so I think there was a lot more of a connection as to how food was grown, where it came from. Mm-hmm. It was more decentralized. So you could see farmers and producers in your area, no matter where you lived, you know, excluding the big cities. At this point in time in 2020, less than 1% of Americans are farmers. So there are a lot of people who do not have any connection, right? They don't know a farmer. They maybe have never been on a farm.
Wow.
And with that is a disconnection of from where their food comes from and how it's raised. And there's so much marketing out there that it is a confusing topic. But at the end of the day, I don't think people realize what industrial agriculture has become in the past 75 years. Right, the chemicals and the technology that they're using are profitable for the chemical companies, but they don't promote good soil health, and therefore they don't promote good plant health, and they don't promote good human health.
Right.
And the marketing kind of glosses over that, and people, I think, either don't understand that or they get conflicting messages. A lot of people ask, well, how bad can it be? You know, but they just don't know what's being used. And a lot of these chemicals, you know, most of them are poisons,
right?
You're either poisoning insects or fungus. A lot of the research coming out of universities is not looking, they're not asking the right questions. Mm-hmm. They're looking at how these chemicals are used to make farming easier or to reduce risk, and they have never really looked at what is the effect of long-term exposure of these chemicals on humans.
So it's not really geared towards human health, it's geared more towards the bottom line and producing higher yields?
Yeah, but not even the bottom line of farmers. Because if you look at the history of farming in this country, farmers have been taking it on the chin for the past 75 years.
Right.
Especially now, when we think of farming, a lot of it is commodity farming, right? They're growing corn and soybeans and wheat. Mm-hmm. They're not selling to local markets. A lot of it goes to export. These are really large farms. And
like export out of country export?
Out of country export. Our yields are so high now that we grow enough food in this on the planet to feed 14 billion people.
In the U.S. alone?
I think that's globally.
Globally, okay, got it.
So we're overproducing food.
Yeah.
Distribution is our problem. The reason we have hunger is we can't get food where it needs to be. Mm-hmm. But we're overproducing food, and farmers are infamous for doing that. They focused on yields. Mm-hmm. They grow more food than we need, which drives prices down.
Right.
So in the last 7 years, if you're a commodity farmer, chances are you are losing money on every acre of crop that you're growing.
Wow, that's bad.
The only reason you can continue to do it is because a government subsidy makes you whole at the end of the year.
Right.
So with the focus on yield coming out of, you know, agribusiness and the USDA, Department of Agriculture, it's been pushing farmers to get bigger, to use more technology, to use more chemicals. It's making the agribusiness sector wealthy, but farmers are not doing well. And consumers are getting lower quality food. So the middlemen are getting the money, and the people who you would think of in a food system, right? You think of a food system as food producers and food consumers.
Yeah.
They're both losing out in the current system.
Right.
So
kind of like doctors in primary care, for example, and the insurance model in the healthcare system in the US, and the middleman being insurance and big pharma, and then the consumer being the patients.
Right.
Like the patients and the doctor are losing out. And in this scenario, the farmers and the consumer of the produce are losing out in the big agribusiness model.
Yeah, definitely the medical field and the agricultural field have been on a similar trajectory for the past 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
on the bright side, I think a lot of farmers, because farmers are not doing well in this environment, they're starting to question the information that they're receiving. And they're starting to realize, like, here we are, we're farming, we're using synthetic inputs, fertilizers that are really expensive. We're using all these toxic chemicals that are dangerous and expensive. Mm-hmm. And so it's harming our soil, which means we have to use more and more every year to produce the same amount of food. We're losing money on the food we're producing. And they're trying to break that cycle. And so they're actually going back to older techniques. You know, instead of looking for a new technological fix or a new GMO crop, they're actually realizing that there are practices as farmers that they can use. It can go by different terms: conservation agriculture, regenerative agriculture, just the idea that you have to treat your soil like a living organism.
Right.
Because it is. It's a whole ecosystem. Mm-hmm. Right? And all that life that's in your soil is what leads to growing healthy plants and animals, whether those animals are us as humans or animals that we're going to eat as meat. It all starts with the soil.
Okay.
That's something that the industrial model doesn't recognize. They treat it as if it's a sterile media that they're just going to, every year they're going to add what's needed. So farmers are moving back towards conservation practices slowly, because there's a lot of peer pressure not to do that. But I am kind of, it's hard to say, I'm optimistic that we're moving in the right direction, but it's coming from the ground up.
Right.
It's like individual farmers are trying to do the right thing for themselves. Even if it's starting with just trying to save money, it's leading to better practices, leading to better food. But it's not ever going to come, that change is not going to come from the top down.
Right.
Chemical companies are never going to tell farmers to use less chemicals. Mm-hmm. Right. Unless they have another product to replace it with.
Yeah.
And the USDA is not telling farmers, I mean, overall message is not telling farmers just to use good practices.
Right.
And again, it comes back to that concept of you can't make a lot of money telling farmers to do good practices. You can't monetize that.
Right.
But you can monetize selling them fertilizers and chemicals. So we have these competing interests.
And seeds, right? Or like GMO.
Yeah. GMO seed is a copyrighted. You can't even save your own seed. It's another way to keep market share and make money every year.
So I remember a pretty big marketing campaign in the 90s around GMO crops. And what my friends were telling me who were kind of bought into this, which I didn't, but they bought into that GMO crops are going to solve world hunger. And we're going to get more yield from these GMO crops. And that's going to just be the solution. And that's it. What is that? What have we actually found? What's the, you know, proof here for or against GMO crops and solving like this yield issue? And you're already saying we have too much food.
Right. And, so, and that's what I would say is the spin, the marketing on that is, and if you ask a conventional farmer what they are doing, you know, they're very proud of the fact that they're feeding the world. And that term is used over and over again. We'll do whatever we have to do to feed the world, not recognizing that they're already overproducing. Right? GMOs definitely started off on a rocky path because they weren't, again, you can genetically modify a plant for a variety of traits. And if you had started with a trait that improved human health, maybe GMOs would be more widely accepted.
Right.
But we started off almost entirely with genetically modified crops solely to be herbicide resistant.
Right.
So that farmers, it would be easier to farm and chemical companies could sell more chemicals and they could also sell these patented seeds that had to be bought every year.
So that's like the Roundup Ready corn as an example.
Yeah. And they were so widely adopted because it made farming easier. Farmers could shift from a heavy tillage-based operation, which was slow and tedious, to a spraying-based system. The spray rig covered more ground faster. So farmers had less work to do. They could either get bigger or they would have more free time. So farmers adopted it. consumers didn't really have a choice. They weren't given a choice.
Right.
And it was adopted so rapidly that when, say, or GMO sugar beets first came out, within the first year, 100% of sugar beets grown in this country were GMO. And I don't think the consumer knew that. And people would say, well, I can't remember the last time I ate a sugar beet, right? Not realizing that so much processed sugar that's in all of our processed food is coming from a GMO beet, which was modified solely to have Roundup sprayed over the top of it. And so the average consumer is getting a ton of exposure to pesticides. Any processed food probably has corn or soy or sugar in it. And those are all coming from commodity crops grown with chemical industrial agricultural practices.
And usually it's Roundup and other pesticides, or Roundup's an herbicide, right? So like other pesticides with Roundup as well, sprayed together, or just?
Chemicals have always been used. What's really changed, and again, this is not seeing farming in action. A lot of people wouldn't realize it, but a lot of chemical spraying that happened before GMOs, it happened before a crop was planted. Like a pre-emergent herbicide, they spray the weeds on the soil, and then the crop would come up. Mm-hmm. Or some could be sprayed directly on the crop. But with GMO technology, you were able to spray the crop while it was growing directly with Roundup.
Right.
Which meant there's more chemical on the plant, and these are systemic herbicides. So they're not just on the surface. You don't just wash off these herbicides, right? They go in, they go into the plant. And if you're thinking about corn, when corn is putting on the ear, right, all of the energy of the plant is focusing on producing that ear.
Right.
So when you spray that, all of that is being directed right to the ear, which is the part that you're eating. So it's getting concentrated there. So back to your point of like, why organic versus why conventional? There's way more pesticide exposure in food than I think people realize.
Right.
And if you look at, you hear the stat that 80% of food in the grocery store contains some product from a GMO plant. And if you just assume that that GMO plant was GMO because of herbicide, right? You're getting basically chronic exposure to herbicide in your food.
Okay. So let's break it down even more now that we kind of have this background that most foods are going to be sprayed with Roundup. We have corn, we have these other big monocrops, wheat. In the past, we've talked about hops and beer being sprayed with Roundup and sugar beets being used as a sugar substitute in a lot of foods that are packaged. So like Wheaties is not the breakfast of champions anymore.
Right.
And, you know, corn flakes is out the door too. So we have, like, through the environmental working group, I usually tell patients, you know, avoid the dirty dozen, eat the clean 15. And if you can't afford organic foods after that, then the clean 15, you know, usually things that have like a thick skin are going to be less likely to be as saturated inside the part of the fruit or the vegetable that you're going to eat with, you know, glyphosate, Roundup, or other herbicides and pesticides. So I'm just curious, like, is that even enough for most people? Like, do most of us just need to go full organic? I mean, I personally try to eat organic 100% of the time. It's kind of hard when you go out to eat, but in your own home, you can pretty much control that. So when somebody's like going to the grocery,
when you save on auto insurance for driving safe with USAA Safe Pilot, you'll feel like a big deal, even in a traffic jam. Save up to 30% with USAA Safe Pilot. Restrictions apply.
I'm on a city street in Virginia, standing in an empty parking space where just last night, Bob's car was stolen. Did you see Bob's car get stolen? Probably not. But do you know who's been stealing cars in Virginia? You could get a reward of up to $25,000. Submit a confidential tip at heatreward.com or call 1-800-947-HEAT. The HEAT program from the Virginia State Police. Reported. Rewarded.
Grocery store, and they're like, okay, I'm going to buy, you know, these vegetables and these things. What are the areas that, from a farmer's point of view, that they should avoid completely?
It's a tough one because you're basically asking how much poison is too much.
Right.
And that's a tricky question to answer. I know with my own medical care, there's that idea of, you know, your body has is a bucket and you can tolerate some toxins to a point, but mm-hmm. when that bucket is full, you start to see symptoms, right? So right. how much consumption of pesticide residue, how quickly does that fill your bucket? You know, how do we even know? So we're talking like this is a preventative approach to being healthy. You know, if you buy food that is certified organic, that there is no herbicide or pesticide residue.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It, organic program stands for a lot of other things that people don't think of. Crop rotations and pollinator habitat, which really doesn't matter to the consumer.
Right.
Truly, to a consumer, the most important point is like, is that food safe to eat? Is it healthy to eat? It's not just a question of Roundup. You know, commodity crops that are GMO, certainly Roundup, but fruits, the fruit industry, tons of insecticides, mm-hmm. mandated whether there's bugs or not, because grocery stores don't want fruit flies in the store. So a lot of fruit growers are mandated by their growing cooperatives to spray. So fruits get a ton. Strawberries in California, some horrible methyl bromide, some really toxic substances, commonplace in the production of that. And like I said, I think there's a misunderstanding that if you spray these pesticides on fruit and vegetables, you can just wash them off in the sink and then suddenly they're good. You know, that's not true.
So and chemically, aren't they more like fat soluble compounds? They're not water soluble compounds. The sprays are like very oily.
Right.
Correct.
Yeah. So, typically.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are lots of side effects. I mean, they're like proven endocrine disruptors, and we know that. And we think, oh, well, the farmer wears a mask when he sprays it.
Yeah.
So maybe he's protected if you believe that.
Right.
But then they don't talk about, well, what does the consumer do then when they're eating it? Right. Like, what's their form of protection?
Right.
So again, there's a lot of misinformation out there. And obviously, there's a lot of entrenched interest in the chemical agribusiness world. So it's really up to the consumer to learn about it and make good choices.
Yeah.
You know, it's not black and white. It's tough. Even with organic, people will say, well, if I'm buying organic, then clearly it's good food for me. It's like, well, yes and no. There's a lot of nuance. What I would encourage people to do is really look at the source of where their food is coming from. Because there are the same corporations that make GMO seeds, big interests like that. They see that organics is a fast-growing sector of the food system. They see that there's profit to be made. They're moving into organic farming, not because they believe in the principles,
right,
but because of the financial part of it.
Big business.
Big business.
So for organic certification for a farm like yours and any other organic certified farm, I used to work one summer I worked on a vegetable farm in my hometown of Vermont. And I remember the cornfields were away from all the other fields. And we did have, it basically was like they looked like pellets. Like if anyone's had like a fish or a turtle or something, they looked like turtle food or something. And we basically threw those all around the corn to try to keep the weeds down. And it was an herbicide, but it wasn't sprayed. So it wasn't on the plant. It was on top of the soil. And that was supposed to keep the weeds down. It didn't work very well, but it was still approved with organic. So my question is some people that are maybe like more well-researched or more kind of skeptical of everything are skeptical of like what organic means now, since you're mentioning it as big business. I'm curious, like, what is allowed within organic? What is not allowed? You know, can you use any pesticides and herbicides?
Yeah. So the organic, I would say the organic label, right, the USDA certified organic label is the strongest label out there still to this day.
Yeah.
Because it guarantees no use of synthetic fertilizer, herbicides, pesticides.
Yeah.
There is a lot of turmoil right now in the organic world because, as I mentioned, the USDA is, you know, very pro technology, very pro big business. And big business wants a piece of organic. And so they've been watering down, even though the rules of organics are federal law, they are written into a rule. Companies are trying to water down the enforcement of those rules. And if you read the original organic legislation, it is all soil based. It talks about the idea that you are as a farmer growing healthy soil first and foremost. That healthy soil grows healthy plants equals healthy people. So if you would think of that concept, hydroponics would make no sense.
Right.
They're not growing an ecosystem that even has soil. You're ignoring the whole, it's a reductionist mindset to think that hydroponics is going to have the same level of nutrition as a soil growing crop in a well-balanced soil. Yet, due to corporate pressure this past year, hydroponics were now approved for organic certification.
Wow.
Much to the dismay of organic farmers who are in it for the value system of organics.
Right.
And so there's things like that going on that the organic community is struggling with. Animal concentrated feed operations, you know, you want to think organic cattle means out on pasture, not necessarily.
Wow.
But overall, as a consumer, it still means you're not getting exposed to pesticide residue.
Right.
And there are natural pesticides, like you're mentioning, that can be used. Items like pyrethrin, which come from the carnation or chrysanthemum family. So it's not to say we can't use toxins, but they tend to not be toxins that affect humans. They're species specific. Like BT is used, it only affects caterpillars.
Okay.
Not humans. So I think people will hear, oh, you can use pesticides in organic. That means obviously it's just a farce and they're fake rules. I would say no. It's still a very, very strict rules. We get inspected every year.
Okay.
We know the rules we have to follow. But I would argue that the people who got into organic farming initially, they were doing it not to simply meet the minimum standard.
Right.
You know, most people are passionate about the cause and they are trying to like raise the bar. They're trying to grow to a very high standard. And so a lot of big agribusinesses are not. They're probably trying to hit the bare minimum.
Right.
Which comes back to my point of not all organic is created equal.
Right. So know your farmer, know where your produce comes from.
I would, yes. It's like right now it's pretty common to bash meat, right? Climate change and beef is bad. And
it's
like we're painting with broad brush strokes. And I think what people are missing is that when we raised, like in North America, we had this prairie ecosystem that relied on ungulates to graze and fertilize and actually sequester carbon through healthy, diverse landscapes.
Right.
So having animals on the land was actually helping with the carbon issue. When we moved animals to feedlots and we concentrated waste in one spot and we broke that ecological model, issues came about.
But if we put it back together, it's actually closing the circle.
Yeah. And you start to look at, okay, well, not all beef is created equal. Beef that is grass-fed is high in omega-3s, low in omega-6s.
Yep.
It can be good. It can be like wild fish once was.
Right.
Right. Whereas beef from a feedlot, high in omega-6s, low in omega-3s, not good for you. So it's not just beef is bad for you. Beef from certain sources is bad for you.
Right.
And beef from other sources can be good for you. Same with fish. We now farm a lot of fish. Guess what we use? We have all this surplus commodities. Guess what we feed our farmed fish? Corn pellets. So now you're pumping fish full of a non-natural diet and wild fish are still very healthy for you. Farmed fish, not the same attributes. A lot of greenwashing there. it's hard to tell when you have farmed salmon versus wild salmon.
Right. So I just heard that, I think it was somewhere outside of, off the coast of British Columbia near maybe like Vancouver Island or something, they had some farm fish escape the netted area. And this was probably last month, like December 2019. And I don't know if they captured all the farm fish and put them back. Probably not. But now those are mating with and interbreeding with the wild fish.
Yeah. So, and they can be different species. A lot of farm fish are Atlantic salmon compared to Pacific salmon. There is also now an approved genetically modified salmon. So like, when you start to talk about releases out into the wild, you're now, I would argue, polluting your natural gene pool.
Yeah.
Right. We're not doing GMOs in a lab. We're doing them out on the landscape. I don't know if you can ever put that genie back in the bottle.
Yeah, that's scary to me. I mean, I've always studied science and kind of consider myself a, you know, a scientist, but also growing up in Northern New England, always big on environmental protection and regulations there and organic farming and things like that, because that was just how I grew up and it was kind of normal there, right? Kind of what you're talking about growing up on a farm in Connecticut. For people that don't have similar backgrounds to us, it seems like a lot of people were talking about like this disconnection, but it seems like a lot of people intellectually like to argue that we've always been genetically modifying our food for eons or like thousands of years since we started, stopped being so much, hunters and gatherers and became more agricultural based communities on these major river valleys throughout the world, you know, the Nile in Egypt, other river systems in Persia and stuff like that, and China, et cetera. So what I'm curious is like, what's your take on that as a scientist? You have a master's in wildlife ecology and wildlife science, as well as growing up on a farm and being an organic farmer now. What is your kind of like response to someone who's like, well, hey, you know, we've always been kind of messing with these foods?
I think that is marketing spin.
Yeah.
From the standpoint of, there are ways to select for traits through natural breeding.
Mm-hmm.
If it occurs in nature, right, evolution, yes, you can modify genetics through selecting natural plant breeding, right? You can take a poodle and a black lab and breed them together for a labradoodle.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
I guess you could call that genetic modification. What the proponents of GMOs are not saying, though, and what is unique about what's happening with plants is it is transgenic genetic modification. We are taking DNA from two species that could never breed in nature. Mm-hmm. These are novel organisms that have never existed before.
Right.
You're taking bacteria and breeding it with plants, or you're taking DNA from a fish and you're putting it into the tomato to make the flavor saver tomato. So these things, this type of genetic modification never happened before in the past thousands of years. It's genetic modification at a different level.
Right.
And there's no constraints on it like there would be in nature, right? If you had some faulty breeding, that whatever it was would probably die, right? It would be selected against.
Yeah.
Here you're doing it in a lab. So you're basically changing the blueprint. You're basically saying that whether you believe in God or you believe in evolution, you as a scientist thinks you can do it better.
Yeah, than you're either one playing God.
Yeah, you're changing the blueprint. And not just in a lab with a guinea pig, you're doing it with our world's food system.
It's very scary to me.
It's high risk.
Yeah.
There's another issue too, though, is you can, whether or not you agree with genetically modifying food, like the messing with the blueprint part of it.
Right.
That's one piece of it. But the fact that we're modifying it for herbicide resistance as a goal, GMOs now have two things against them. It's like the blueprint part and the pesticide residue part.
Right.
And so even if you can defend genetic modification, how do you get around the fact that you're now spraying all this chemical onto a crop?
Right. And what I've seen clinically with farmers in Eastern Washington state alone, there's a lot of apple orchards. You know, we have Washington State's known for its apples, you know, so we have these apple orchards as an example, and they're spraying the hell out of them. And these men come in and they can't feel their hands, you know, these chemical produced neuropathies. And it's from, everybody knows it's from the spray. The farmer knows it's from the spray. I know it's from the spray. But for some reason, this is some big mind-blowing concept to the average person. And I'm not trying to criticize the average person, but I think we have, the marketing has almost won. We're, and luckily though, in the last 2 years, unfortunately for these people who are dying of cancer, of Hodgkin's lymphoma, there's been major lawsuits against Monsanto, Bayer Monsanto Corporation, and people have gotten almost like $300 million. This one guy was a groundskeeper in the North San Francisco Bay, and hopefully people have already heard about this, but I'm just mentioning it as an example. And there's been other lawsuits against them. Although recently I heard that the U.S. government favored Monsanto's favor in the last lawsuit. So I think the big corporation has started to figure out how to get their lawyers online and work around this. But long story short, it's carcinogenic.
I mean, yeah. And that's not a new story.
No.
Right? Yeah. Of corporations having their will, the revolving door between corporations and government agencies.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what they're going for.
Yeah. And
I would say that, yes, they are winning. So as an individual, what does that tell you? Like, there really is no one looking out for your best interests other than you, which means that's a bummer in an age where we're so busy and we want convenience and we want it to be easy, putting the burden on people to say, hey, don't stop listening to what you're hearing from you know, the food system and from the government and start doing your own research. It's like, that's a big burden.
It is, yeah.
And without going down the rabbit hole of discussing what motivates people to make good decisions, I mean, if you look at tobacco, right, and what went with that, like a lot of denial that it was bad for us, then we knew it was bad for us, it kills us. 25% of Americans still smoke, something like that.
Yeah,
it's a fairly high number.
Still pretty high, yeah.
So even if you give a person good information, it does not guarantee that they make good decisions.
Definitely not.
And that's a clear-cut case with tobacco.
Yeah.
When it comes to something like conventional versus organic food, where you can throw in a lot of different arguments, what are the chances everybody's going to make good decisions?
Right.
And again, that's a tough one.
Yeah.
So.
And the fast food industry is wrapped in that too. And it, I mean, I think there's a certain naivete if people aren't fully educated, you know, I think the naive, ignorant person who is just kind of blissfully trying to eat their breakfast cereal with milk and go throughout their day and get their Subway sandwich and then their, you know, burger from the place near their work and just get back to work. They're not, you know, they're not tuned into how this can affect their health or how it's affecting the environmental impact along the way. And they're just having like their salmon they think might be wild because it says it's wild or says it's Pacific salmon, although even though it's Atlantic salmon, et cetera, all these things we're talking about. And what I've heard some people say is like, well, isn't the FDA, and I almost laugh at this, but isn't the FDA supposed to protect our food? You know, the F part stands for food and drug administration. So they're supposed to be making sure there's not certain toxins in our food. The food's not carcinogenic. There's not things that are going to make us have diseases or get sick or contamination. So where does that come in on the bigger scale of policy? And we can also get to the state level of what organic means, maybe in Montana state in a minute. But, you know, why isn't the FDA stepping in and saying like, hey, cut this stuff out. You know, people are dying of cancer now.
I would come back to the revolving door of people. The term is agency capture.
Yeah.
Right. If you're a politician, you look at our government in this country, especially the current administration is a great example. You have, say, the Bureau of Land Management, all these career people who have degrees in resource management, forestry, wildlife, And when a president gets elected, he or she gets to put a political appointee with no knowledge in this subject area into mm-hmm. place to dictate what that agency does.
Right.
In the case of our current administration, we have anti-public land people running public land management agencies. Right. You have the head of the EPA, they're coal lobbyists, right?
Right.
The Interior Department, Bernhardt, was a lobbyist for extractive industries. So you have these people whose motives are completely opposite what the role of the agency is.
Right.
And that filters down through policy.
Right.
And so you can't think that the FDA is there to protect you.
Right. Because they're getting paid. Their pockets are lined.
Yeah, or they've been put in there through political contributions, mm-hmm. right, to do exactly what they're doing, to favor right. the corporate interests
right.
over the health of consumers. Again, that's not a new story in this country.
Not at all. Yeah.
I think when that person wakes up in the morning and they're eating their Cheerios or their Wheaties, a lot of people have seen glimpses of what the food system is.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They've seen disturbing images of 100,000 chickens crammed in a building. They've seen feedlots, they've seen crop dusters, but they want to kind of have an ignorance about it, because otherwise it puts more of a burden on them to make good choices.
Yeah.
And so it's sort of the head in the sands, you know, ignorance is bliss approach, where maybe they say, well, even if I wanted to make good choices aren't available to me.
Right.
In a lot of places in this country, that is true. There are a lot of food deserts in this country.
Yeah.
As agriculture has focused on commodity crops and getting bigger, there are lots of towns and counties in this country where there really isn't any local food that people could even eat. It took us 100 years to get here, though.
That's crazy to think about that.
And so we can't switch it back in a day.
No.
And a lot of work that we're involved with is getting back to the idea of a community food system. And the mm-hmm. definition of that is a food system that is value-based.
Right.
Values-based. Meaning we're not just focusing on maximizing profit in the production of food.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about community vibrancy, human health, landscape health, wildlife habitat, clean water, clean air, all these other values that need to be considered.
Right.
Right. And then how do we rebalance our food system to be more in line with what I think people want it to be?
Yeah.
And we're always butting up against, well, convenience and ease and cheap food.
Yeah.
Right. And I think we're working through it. I'm not saying it can't happen, but it's a slow process.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of education that goes on.
Yeah.
You have to educate people about how cheap food really isn't cheap due to the government subsidies involved in it. It's very complicated.
Yeah. I remember going to like a state fair, I think it was in Washington State actually. And someone had a chart there about the dairy industry. And I grew up in Vermont, and you can drive around my hometown and there's a bunch of dairy farms. And, you know, I grew up eating Ben and Jerry's, and so eating cheese and crackers before every meal with like Wheat Thins and cheese from Vermont. And it was just kind of part of our life. And to realize that the dairy industry has been subsidized, and there's, like you're saying, with a lot of monocrops, there's this surplus of dairy. And then these dairy farms are struggling to make ends meet, similar to like most of these big farms. So I think when a lot of my patients, when I talk to them, it's like, hey, do you realize like, it's not like your uncle's farm anymore and you can go get like some raw whole milk.
Right.
And this milk actually isn't even, if you can digest it, if you're not lactose intolerant or completely dairy intolerant, then you're getting all these chemicals and it's estrogenic and all these things for men. And, you know, we're talking about all these other chemicals that are estrogenic in foods or neurotoxins and carcinogenic. So in the education, like you said, it's this bottomless pit of information that people need to get into their system to say, okay, I'm just going to shop the perimeter of the grocery store. I'm going to buy fresh. I'm going to try to buy local if I can. if I'm in somewhere, like you said, like one of these food deserts, like I'm going to do what I can to maybe grow a couple of vegetables in the summer or something on my porch. If I have an apartment, you know, which I did living in suburban Seattle, growing some food in a planter box that we were able to buy from Home Depot. So it's doable for busy people.
Well, I think it's exciting that you'll often hear the stat that the average age of a farmer in this country is 59 years old or older. And for many years, that number was just getting higher and higher and higher. Mm-hmm. And I would say in the past 10 years, especially in vegetables, but in farming in general, there is a renewed interest in young people to getting the food production.
That's
doing it at small scale, organic practices, maybe not certified organic, but mm-hmm. using sustainable practices. So there is a shift there. And a lot of these people are highly educated. They did not come from farm families.
Right.
They don't have access to farmland. But there is a shift in mindset,
mm-hmm.
you know, that maybe that's what had to happen. Maybe by people going into farming who didn't grow up on farms, they don't have some of those bad habits. Let's just say they don't have that mindset. And so they can think outside the box. Again, when you're trying to source good food, like dairy, if you look around your town and you find someone who is raising cattle on pasture, right, and they're getting mm-hmm. access to green grass, or maybe it's chicken eggs, same thing, support them.
Because mm-hmm.
they don't need a huge amount of support to be a viable business.
Right.
I mean, we're in a day and age where everything, the industry is pushing for bigger, right? Get bigger, get out,
mm-hmm.
centralized. We drove through Yuma, Arizona a couple years ago. There was the largest dairy in the country, 40,000 cows.
Wow.
None of them ever grazed on grass. You know, they cut the alfalfa elsewhere and brought it to them. And these cows just stood outside and were milked. As a New England dairy farmer, that's pretty tough to compete with from an economy of scale standpoint.
Yeah.
Right?
Wild. Yeah.
So what you buy isn't just about your health. You're also supporting a type of farming.
Right.
You can support the 40,000 cow dairy. And mm-hmm. if you do that, I'm sure more of them will pop up around the country.
Right.
Or you could support those folks in your town who are trying to make a living as a dairy farm, and maybe they can make a living.
Mm-hmm.
I think it goes way beyond food and health.
Right.
It starts to look at, like, what does your community look like? Do you have agricultural land in your community anymore? Do you have open space? Do rural areas in your state have an economy, or are they all boarded up now and everybody's moved out because there's so few farmers? There's so many different impacts that all stem from what the source of our food is. And I think at the end of the day, it requires an educated consumer.
Yeah. Yeah. And we can, you know, it's like you can vote with your dollar is kind of what I hear you saying is.
Yeah. You know, it's almost cliche, but it is true.
Yeah.
You know, you're voting every single day. Whereas when you're voting for a president, you know, big agriculture is not a partisan issue, right? This push by for big industry happens whether it's a Republican or a Democrat in office.
Right.
Right. So at the end of the day, it's up to a consumer to really think about the far-reaching effects of their purchasing decision.
Yeah.
And again, I realize people are very busy, and that's probably the last thing they want to think about. But it does affect their quality of life.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, we've kind of like broken bread before and like had a meal together. And, you know, I know that you and your wife, Rebecca, eat really well. Like, what do you kind of, as a farmer, recommend that people try to eat if they're just like starting to change their diet and they're kind of like, okay, this just seems so overwhelming. I saw Dr. Sam Madeira and he's like, go paleo or, you know, cut out grains because most all these grains have like Roundup or other pesticides in it. And, you know, most men are drinking like IPAs with hops that has a Roundup on it. And, you know, or they like their whiskey, which is, you know, 51% corn and et cetera, et cetera. So where should someone start? Like if they're just kind of like, okay, like do they find a CSA, like Community Supportive Agriculture Group, if they have access to that? And after they do that, what do you kind of recommend they do?
I would say as a starting point, whether it's at a grocery store or at a farm, go for organic food. Mm-hmm. Because you want to get the pesticide exposure. You want to get rid of that.
Right.
You can debate what the nutritional content is, but I think that's a somewhat lesser concern. You got to get rid of the pesticides first.
Right.
If you have CSAs available or farmers markets available in your town, that's great. But a lot of people don't.
Yeah.
I mean, now there's mail order though. It's a tough one. Like I said, it's ideally there'll be a day where you can actually go to the grocery store where you think about growing food and find access to all this healthy nutritional food. But it's going to take a while to get there.
Right.
I think a lot of the knowledge of like eat a low protein, eat a high protein, low carb, high carb, paleo, all these diet trends, I think are somewhat based on the fact that certain crops grown industrial were bad. Like you look at gluten, modern strains of gluten are very bad for people.
Right.
But historically, the older types of gluten have been proven to be anti-inflammatory. And if you read like Bob Quinn's book, Grain by Grain, mm-hmm. he's a wheat grower in central eastern Montana, growing Khorasan wheats that he got from Egypt. He's a scientist. He's doing the test, and he's showing that this gluten is anti-inflammatory, which goes against the whole idea of what gluten is. But again, wheat has been selectively bred to have high modern gluten strains for bakers.
Right.
So again, eating wheat is not bad for you. Eating modern gluten wheat is bad for you, but you can find older varieties.
I like that approach because when I was in the Tuscany Valley, it's an old farming community, like very ancient farming community in Italy, also known for wine and the beauty of the land, but they have no GMO crops. And we were speaking with a farmer. He had a translator, so he was speaking Italian. And he was like, we have all of these seeds that we've had for like hundreds of years, like going back to the 1500s. And there's no GMO crops. Like people come to Italy, they can eat the bread and they don't have any issue.
Yeah.
And then they come back to North America and they eat the sandwich. And they're like, why do I have all this gut issues now?
Yeah.
So,
and that's if there's one take home point, it's like the source of your food is what matters. I think if people found food that was grown in like a healthy, well-balanced soil without the use of chemicals and they ate a diverse diet, so many health issues would go away. And it wouldn't matter if it was high in carbs or low in protein or high in protein, and that would all fall away as being irrelevant.
Right.
I think we need people to focus on finding nutritious food without chemicals on it. Mm-hmm. And that's where the improvement's going to come from.
Yeah. Eat nutrient dense food and stuff like this. I call it like fake food because it's just like this Franken food, you know, that isn't really.
It's just highly processed to where you're growing with synthetic inputs. So your soil, you know, it's just not a living soil. Mm-hmm. So you're missing out on a lot of the nutrients. It's just getting what it needs to grow.
Right.
So you're missing out on nutrition there. And then so much processing renders any nutrition that was there, that's gone.
Right.
So yeah, we get, in this country, we can have obese people who are malnourished.
Right.
Right. Which means they're getting plenty of calories, tons of calories. Yeah. They're just not getting any nutrition with those calories.
And going back to the soil, nutrients, what I see is that a lot of men and women, but you know, we're talking out of the men's health podcast here, are zinc and magnesium deficient. I think it was you and Rebecca that told me here in Flathead County in the valley, there's zinc deficiency in the soil in general.
Boron is in all Montana, boron is deficient.
Okay.
And so it's not magic. Right. I keep coming back to the same thing. Healthy soil equals healthy plants equals healthy people. If you're growing food in soils that are deficient, that deficiency shows up in the people.
Right.
And we learned this. There were doctors for the draft for World War II who picked up on this, where they could see traits, eyesight or tooth health. They could figure out what part of a state that grouping of people came from based on looking at the health issues and bringing it back to what type of soil and how much rainfall they had. So this is not like new information.
Yeah.
We've known this, that our health is based on the health of the soil.
Right.
And that's tricky because as a farmer, you're doing soil tests, you're trying to balance your soil. But even then, if a nutrient's in the soil, it's not guaranteed that it gets uptaken by a plant. Mm-hmm. So then you're doing tissue samples. It's like there's a lot going on.
Yeah, it's complex.
And it gets complex. But again, it's like we can strive for that. Mm-hmm. But as a starting point for the average person, like that's not really important to think that deep. It's really like moving away from processed foods, mm-hmm. right? Finding fresh foods that are grown with good practices.
Yeah.
And again, we're having to rebuild this food system. So encouraging young farmers or new farmers with your business so that there'll be more farmers, like we're going to have to build back that system. And it is happening. At least I can say it's not like we have to start. It's happening, but there needs to be a lot more of it.
Right.
Just in general, any type of food production, if the average age of a farmer is 59, we need new farmers.
Right.
We might as well support the ones that are coming in to use better practices.
And you shared some kind of staggering facts with me before in some private conversations about how some of these farmers and these big agribusinesses, you know, there's a high suicide rate for farmers. And I don't think most people are aware of that for these conventional farms. And, you know, families are having to live in their house all summer during like the hottest time of the year because of the spraying and the crop dusting going over the house. And kids are getting, you know, autoimmune diseases and neurodegenerative diseases and higher sickness rates in the families. Hopefully that kind of awareness can help people to support more of the organic farming. Are you seeing like things like crop dusting happening in the Flathead Valley still? And, you know, what
sure,
is that?
Sure
like?
Do.
Yeah.
you're trying to provoke me.
Yeah. trying to get people to be aware of like, you know, this isn't something you see on like a black and white video, like going back to like the 50s, like post World War II.
We routinely have, even near our farm, we're surrounded by agricultural lands. Most of it is either wheat production or canola.
Yeah.
A lot of canolas. I think Montana is the second leading producer of canola. And if there's insect pressures, I mean, if there's weed pressures in the spring, they're spraying, you know, on the ground with a boom. You can often smell that herbicide in the air. And then later in the summer, if they have insect pressure and they can't drive machinery on the mature crop, they'll use a crop dusting plane.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a concern. I mentioned disconnect. We'll hear a lot of people say, hey, did you see that stunt plane flying around this weekend? You know, like they don't realize what it's doing.
Wow.
They just think it's a low flying aircraft.
Because it looks like a stunt plane?
Well, it's just because it's flying low and it's looping around and heading back and forth. And they just, like in their mind, they don't even think what, like they've never seen a crop duster before.
Right.
So there's concerns that, you know, you're not just getting the exposure when you're eating it, but like mm-hmm. where you live, you're exposed to it. It's a lot of the herbicides and chemicals are ending up in our water supplies, especially in the Midwest.
Yeah.
So now you're dealing with it there. So there's just more and more exposure, to the point of like suicide. I think that's just a function of an industrial commodity system, right?
Right.
We have so few farmers anymore and they're farming huge areas. So that the only place agriculture is really growing now is in the size of massive farms and tiny farms. The middle of agriculture, the family farm, has more or less disappeared in this country.
Wow.
So imagine you're out there by yourself, you're doing your 5,000 acres, your 10,000 acres. It's very isolating.
Yeah.
The only people you really see are like down at the diner, farmers just like you, or you're at the seed warehouse in the chemical company, and they're telling you your information, and you realize that it's not working, right?
Right.
You're spending all this money, you have massively high input costs, high equipment costs, low price for your food. So you're losing money every year, which means you're having to take a handout in the form of a government subsidy, which a lot of agriculture is in conservative areas. Like, that doesn't feel good to be having to take a subsidy to make a living.
Wears on you.
80%, I think, of farmers, of that 1%, have to work. Someone in the house has to work an off-farm job to help pay the bills to support the farm.
Wow.
And then your kids see what you're doing, and they decide, there's no way I'm taking over this operation. I'm moving to Seattle or wherever, right?
LA or San Francisco or New York City or something.
And who do you go to for help, right? Well, you're not going to go down to the diner and complain to your buddies, because they're going to, you know, they're going to tell you you're nuts. So you're in that setting. And I mean, it's sad to say, but the last statistic I saw is conventional commodity farmers have a suicide rate that's 4 times the national average.
Wow, that's high.
Right? And that's a tough way to get out of farming.
Yeah, that's rough.
Right. Whereas if they had some support, I mean, not just like mental health support, but if they had, if they could, and you're seeing in like South Dakota, there's a pocket of farmers who are moving to no-till agriculture, reducing the cost of their inputs, their yields are staying the same or even higher. And all of a sudden they're checking all the boxes where they're like, wow, I can make a living because my soil is healthier because I'm not tilling. It's not that I'm choosing not to use herbicides. I don't need to use as many herbicides.
Right.
So by trying to save money, they're achieving the goal of using less chemicals.
Yep.
These farms are vibrant. They're successful on all accounts. It's just that the only way other farmers are adopting that is by like looking over the fence or hearing these farmers talk. And so it's slow. It's like there's these cells around the country that this change is radiating out from, but it's a slow process.
Mm-hmm. And the no-till agriculture is important. Why is that important?
Another can of worms.
Yeah.
No-tillage, we're talking about soil life.
Yep.
Tillage is disruptive. It's disruptive to the microbiology. It burns up the organic matter, which the microbiology are feeding on.
Mm-hmm.
It's disruptive to fungal networks, which are really important on pulling minerals and nutrients through the soil to plants.
Mm-hmm.
In the Midwest, there's a lot of erosion because of it. So you're actually losing your topsoil. So you're losing organic matter and you're losing your topsoil. There's so many issues with tillage that no-till addresses. You're less disturbance. Yeah. The problem with no-till in this country is it's been adopted in an industrial manner where they swapped, instead of tilling, they don't till, but they use chemical herbicides to kill off crops, which is kind of like, what's the lesser of two evils?
So they're not even doing cover crops anymore.
Well, they are, but how do you incorporate a cover crop into the soil if you can't till it in? You spray it with Roundup and then you plant into that. So there's still issues even with no-till. The big push now is, how do you move towards organic no-till?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big challenge that they're still working out, but that I think is the best of both worlds. Where you can have a healthy, you can actually build soil fairly rapidly just by tilling it less, cover cropping it, and doing diverse rotations.
Mm-hmm.
And you go to the Midwest, there are people growing corn and soybeans, corn and soybeans, corn and soybeans.
Yeah.
Some people are growing corn. We know that that's not a good way to farm.
Right.
And again, it gets complicated. They do that in part because they need crop insurance, and the USDA doesn't want to offer crop insurance when farms have really complicated crop rotations. They prefer like a two crop rotation. Even though we know like these super complicated rotations with more species diversity results in healthier soil, a lot of farmers will not adopt that practice because they're afraid they can't get crop insurance.
Wow.
And so there's these barriers that we're always bumping up against, but it slows down the change, but I think the change is happening regardless.
Right. So, I mean, it seems like from what I've heard that people are able, you know, the farmer's going to be healthier if they can go organic. And obviously that's a big change, not just a paradigm shift, but a business change. The farmer's going to be healthier. The land's going to be healthier. If they go no-till with organic, the soil will be healthier. So the food will be better for the consumer and potentially better yield as well from
the fields. And the big one now that is waking people up is climate change.
Right.
If you think about pre-settlement times in this country, soil is made up of minerals, water, air, and organic matter, which is like old plant debris. The most stable of that is humus, which you've probably heard of.
Yep.
Right? That organic matter plays a huge role in soil in terms of holding water so that when farmers get rain, instead of it running off or eroding their soil, it holds that water in place. It's what the microbiology feed on. It's where fertility comes from. Mm-hmm. And it's basically soil carbon. Mm-hmm. Pre-settlement times, estimates are between 7 to 15% organic matter in our soils. There are parts of the country where we're under 1% right now.
Whoa.
So by tilling and injecting oxygen into our soils, it's burning off that organic matter, releasing the carbon into the atmosphere, right? So there's a big push now to get so much of the carbon that we have in our atmosphere could be put back into the soil by reducing tillage. And I think that's really one of the big pushes, whether we incentivize that through a government program or the consumers ask for it. It's kind of an exciting way to deal, a very easy one that does not require high technology solutions. It's like, if we just kept plants growing.
Yeah.
Right? I was listening to a Joe Rogan podcast. Elon Musk was on there.
Yeah.
And he made the statement like, if tomorrow I can invent a machine that took carbon out of the air and put it into the ground, I would do it tomorrow.
Right.
And as a farmer, I almost fell off of my chair because he just described a plant. Yep. That's exactly what a plant does through photosynthesis. It takes carbon dioxide out of the air and it stores it and sequesters it in the soil.
Yep.
Simply by keeping cover crops across all of our farmland, never letting bare soil exist, you can still grow your commercial crop. But when you're done, you put in these cover crops. That alone would address a huge chunk of carbon climate change. So it's just shifting the mindset. Like, how do you get farmers to recognize this and adopt it? And how do you get consumers to pay for that or to recognize that?
Right.
Right. And I think we're still figuring that out.
Yeah. We're in kind of the beginning of that farming revolution. It seems like it's a dire straits kind of situation, because on the health end, it's completely necessary because we're literally poisoning ourselves, the farmer included, and the consumer. And on the economical side, it's also not working out. It's not panning out as you're saying. So it seems like we have to go this way, you know, and people are motivated by money. So hopefully that can be part of the motivation.
Well, that's the thing, is there are some people doing well in the current system. It's the big agribusinesses in the middle.
Right.
And that's where the barrier is, because they have the money to advertise. They can fill the internet with misinformation. They can spin the facts. They'll do whatever they need to do to maintain their market share.
Right.
And so that's what we're up against. Mm-hmm. You know, nothing new. But I think the fact that the consumer is being harmed and the farmer is being harmed, the more we cut out that middle man, the less dependent we are on synthetic inputs. You know, farmers can produce on-farm fertility, you know, even better. They suddenly become more independent and maybe deal more directly with consumers. We can get around that issue.
Excellent. So I want to bring it back to your farm here in Flathead County, Montana. So you guys go to the farmer's market in Whitefish, is it? Every week during the growing season?
We started on a quarter acre primarily as a CSA farm. Mm-hmm. So community supported agriculture, where we offered a weekly share of vegetables The customer would pay up front in the winter. It would give us the cash we needed to get going in the growing season. And then from mid-May to late September, we would provide them a box of fresh produce. We started with 24 of those. We're up to 250.
Nice.
We started with one market. We're now do 3 weekly markets, Whitefish, Kalispell, and Columbia Falls. We work with some friends who started a local distribution company for serving wholesale accounts like restaurants. And I believe there's between 40 to 60 restaurants in the Valley who purchase our food.
Nice.
Through that. The dilemma for us has been we started on a quarter acre and our goal was to get more good food into the community. Mm-hmm. And we're realizing it's insatiable appetite for it once people start to eat it.
Yeah.
But we don't want to be that big. So right. we're at the point now where we've more or less capped our production. Like we can only do as much as we can do.
Right.
And so now we've shifted to supporting new farmers.
That's great.
And handing off opportunities to other farmers. Because I do think once people taste, you go to your farmer's market and you taste those carrots mm-hmm. or that broccoli and there's something about it where you realize this is not the same as what I'm getting in the store.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And that's nutrition, right? Those are BRICS levels. Those are nutrients that you're tasting. And so again, a positive trend. If you look at the number of farmer's markets in the United States, it's increased so much in the past 10 years.
Yeah, it seems like it's a big thing. And it was kind of like part of that whole slow food movement that I think it's still there, but it's kind of lost its spotlight a little bit. But the farmers markets have stayed,
right.
and kept going.
So. Yeah, because I don't think they're like trendy. They're trendy and hip, but it's more than that. Like parents with the young kids, they're realizing how important it is. And yep. so they're committed to it and they're not going there to be cool. They're going there, to find good food for their family.
Right. To do their grocery shopping. And
yeah, there's definitely, I'm fully aware that as a small farmer, we have a lot of work to do and we are working on it as a community of how do we make our food more convenient, more accessible.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to say cheap, right? Because I'm not going for cheap price. I'm going for nutrient density. But I recognize that trying to make someone come out to the farm to get the food or trying to make it to one of 3 farmers markets may not fit their schedule. So trying to grow the local food economy to recognize that,
mm-hmm.
Whether it's a storefront, getting it where it's easier for people, getting it in the grocery stores.
Yeah.
So instead of driving to the farm, all you have to do is move your hand 6 inches to the right, buy the local organic salad mix rather than the other stuff.
Yeah.
So it's a work in progress for sure.
That's excellent. Well, I love what you're doing. I love to hear that, sounds like you're mentoring other farms in the Valley. And this has been a great interview. Thanks for your time. I know you're both very busy. How can people find you on the internet? What's your website for the farm?
Website is twobearfarm.com. Instagram is at twobearfarm, all spelled out, T-W-O-F-A-R-M. No, T-W-O-B-E-A-R-F-A-R-M. Those are the 2 best places. Instagram, you kind of get a view of what we're doing and you see the shares and see what's happening on the farm. Or come find us at a farmer's market.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much, Todd. And everybody go to his website, go to Instagram and follow them there. And please share this podcast with friends and family. Everybody needs to hear this information and to get educated. We got to all work together to make this happen. Have a good one, everyone. See you on the next episode. Bye.
Now here's for my mandatory disclaimer. This is a medical information podcast and is only for general information purposes. It does not substitute or constitute the practice of medicine or any medical practices, including the giving of medical advice to any individual. And please observe that no doctor-patient relationship has been formed here. This medical podcast offers health, hormone, fitness, and nutrition information and is designed for educational purposes only. You should not rely on this information as a substitution for, nor does it replace professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. If you have any concerns or questions about your health, you should always consult with a physician or other healthcare professional. Do not disregard, avoid, or delay obtaining medical or health-related advice and appropriate treatment from your healthcare professional. Users should seek the care of their physician or healthcare professional for any such conditions. The use of any information provided on this podcast is solely at your own risk. The contents and topics of this podcast have not been evaluated by the FDA nor approved by any other government or official body. The topics and content covered is not intended to diagnose, cure, or prevent any disease or disorder of any kind. Developments in medical research may impact the health, fitness, and nutritional advice that appears here on the podcast in the future episodes. No assurance can be given that the advice contained in this podcast will always include the most recent findings or developments in medicine with respect to the particular material covered. If you are in the United States and think you are having a medical or health emergency, call your healthcare professional or 911 immediately. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to hearing your feedback and looking forward to have you on future podcasts. Thank you.